time ago, an American airplane dropped one bomb on Hiroshima.
Ich bin ein Berliner.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this.
The American people, I think, is good people. They have not to charge.
Welcome back, everyone, to the Cold War Podcast, episode 200, as we welcome back writer Michael Holtzman for part two of his interview about his book, Spies and Traitors, Kim Philby, James Angleton, and the friendship and betrayal that would shape MI6, the CIA, and the Cold War.
I love this. In August of 1945, Philby was given the Soviet Order of the Red Banner, and a few months later, in 1945, was given the Order of the British Empire. So he's winning on both fronts.
He didn't wear them at the same time.
that's probably best. Yeah, hope he didn't mix them up.
Yeah,
hope he didn't mix them up. Yeah,
which one? He also had the Franco.
The Franco medal.
There we go.
Oh, he's got a collection. Yeah.
I want medals.
It's like Pokemon. You got to collect them all. And Angleton received a Legion of Merit. Now, after the OSS was dismantled, he joins the SSU and then finally the newly created CIA in 1947. We've done hundreds of episodes on the creation of the CIA, so we won't go over all that again. But we've talked before on the show about how he helped determine the outcome of the Italian elections in 1948. Can you give us a quick précis on that story, a reminder?
Well, this was a U.S. government, official U.S. government operation. Mm-hmm. The American ambassador to Italy, a man named Dunn, who you have to remember was not a fascist.
Right.
Sometimes difficult.
Mm.
was very concerned that the Italian Communist Party would take over, would win an election.
Right.
Which would be not a good thing. It wouldn't be a coup. They would actually get more votes. And this was intolerable.
Right.
So he and the State Department, which there was a coup, kind of a coup in the United States, you know, in 1946, where the New Deal ended. Mm-hmm. And the leaders of the State Department and other functions became interested in rollback anti-communism. So there was an election coming up in 1948 in Italy, a parliamentary election. And the American government was very concerned that the communists would win this. The Communist Party of Italy, the PCI, had great strength in the north of Italy, where they had organized the resistance to the Nazis.
Mm.
As a matter of fact, they had such strength that they just won the elections in the north of Italy yesterday.
Wow.
In any case, this was intolerable. So there was an overt effort, program by the American government of supporting the Christian Democratic Party, which had been created by the United States and the Vatican to combat the PCI. There were radio programs, banners, the importation of wheat was stepped up so people could be alive. That went on. And an enormous amount of money was given to the CIA, or to whichever, you seem to know what the dates here, whichever organization it was that was the CIA at that time. And so Angleton was able to call in the chips from his time in Italy. And these funds were distributed. This was done again in the next election. And in William Colby's memoir, he talks about driving around Rome with his trunk of his car full of Italian currency and stopping in various dark alleys and handing it out to Christian Democratic politicians.
Wow.
And that was probably what was done.
And it wasn't just handing out cash. I think there were threats or implied threats about what would happen in terms of American support for Italy if the elections didn't go the way they wanted it to go. After the defeat in the election, the communist leader Togliatti said, "The elections were not free. Brutal foreign intervention was used, consisting of a threat to starve the country by withholding ERP, which was the
Marshall Plan.
Yeah, the funding.
European recovery.
That's right, the recovery. That's the word I was looking for. Aid, if it voted for the Democratic Front, the menace to use the atom bomb against towns or regions that voted pro-communist." Now, that may be a little bit extreme. I'm not exactly sure that was implied, unless Douglas MacArthur was in control. The CIA, as we've pointed out on their show before, at this point had no independent budget still and no contingency fund for covert operations. It was too early. So the money to fund this buying of the election, officially or unofficially, I guess, historically came from something called the Exchange Stabilization Fund, the ESF, that was set up during the Depression to shore up the value of the dollar overseas through short-term currency trading, and then by some mechanism was converted during World War II as a depository for captured Nazi loot, stolen Nazi loot. In your book, you talk about how the money may have come from some of that. I seem to recall that some of it also came from Marshall Plan funds that were diverted to throwing elections. But the way...
Counterpart funds,
was it? And the way that it got to Italy was fascinating. It was sort of disguised as donations from wealthy, mostly Italian-American citizens sending money to newly created political fronts in Italy formed by the CIA, a lot of it going via the political arm of the Vatican, Catholic Action. And donors were instructed to place a special code on their income tax forms that said charitable donation. So this is America directly interfering in the elections of a European country in 1948. And as I seem to recall, we said on our show, that continued for decades. It was for another 20, 25 years, they kept doing that in Italy.
There were three streams. There were the Marshall Plan counterpart funds, which I could explain to you if I had a glass of wine. then there were the actual legitimate legislated funds that were going to the embassy. And then there were the funds that were being laundered in the way you just described.
And fast forward to the 2016 U.S. election and the outcry in the United States that Russia might have attempted to influence the U.S. election, and how horrified Americans were at the idea of a country trying to influence the elections of another. We were laughing our asses off at the time, going, "Really? this is shocking to Americans that a country might try and influence the elections of another country? Really?"
So that's what Angleton did in there. In the document dump that I talked about earlier, there were the desk diaries of the head of the CIA, what he did hour by hour.
Wow.
And from time to time, it would say, Mr. Angleton and Vice Admiral Spanese, from the head of Italian naval intelligence, are coming to visit the director.
Would have been Roscoe at the time?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that went on, first it was the general.
Adele Smith?
Yeah, he came later.
Eisenhower's chief of staff in the Second World War.
Adele Smith?
Yeah.
Beadle?
Smith.
Beadle.
Anyway, there would be these notations that Angleton's position was that he was the liaison to the Italian intelligence system.
Is that another way of saying Angleton kind of or whatever, controlled, or whatever word we should be using, the various Italian intelligence agency services?
Had great influence.
Great influence. There we go. So not to beat a dead horse, but it sounds like the CIA, for at least a few elections, stopped the communists from winning elections, because that's probably the way the elections would have wanted. I mean, the way the elections would have gone, because that's what the majority of Italian people wanted it, and we denied them that on several occasions for years.
For decades.
Okay, just wanted that pointed out even more. Wow.
So moving on, in 1948, Philby's new wife, because he and Lizzie had sort of, it always seemed to me that that was a bit of a political marriage. It was a marriage of convenience for both.
It wasn't very good for an MI6 official to be married to an Austrian communist.
Good True. Point.
So his new wife, Eileen, in 1948, sets herself on fire, according to one story, or was self-harming in other ways. What do you think that was all about? Did it have anything to do with the fact that an extremely homosexual, alcoholic, communist spy was living in their
Guy Burgess.
Basement? Or that her husband was a secret communist?
She was a sick puppy.
Mm. Right.
I think this is overdetermined. You know, British women of that class had few options in their lives, weren't very well educated. She apparently had nervous breakdowns before they were married.
Mm.
And it probably isn't a really good thing to be married to a sociopath.
Probably not. Do you think she knew that he was a... I mean, obviously, Litzy knew. You don't think Eileen knew? And how did he explain Guy Burgess living in their basement in Washington?
My college friend.
Yeah, my bud.
Yeah, and Guy, you know, Guy's lonely in Washington.
Right.
You know, his habits that seem charming in certain circles in London don't seem charming in Washington.
No.
Did you read my book on Guy Burgess?
No, I don't think so.
The stories that are told about him in Washington are simply not true. He arrives in Washington, and he's adopted by American high society.
Right.
And spends weeks on Long Island playing tennis and going horseback riding with high society people, goes out to horse country, and your horse country,
right,
in Virginia.
Right.
With those people, and is well dealt with. But also, they were all getting under more and more pressure. And Burgess was drinking much too much to actually work. So Philby said, I'm taking care of Guy.
It's a good cover. Well, let me, I wanted to ask about that. Everybody seems to be an alcoholic. Is it the stress? Is it the double life? Is it just what you do in that particular set of the elite or whatever?
Dulles was an alcoholic. Churchill was an alcoholic.
A high-functioning
Stalin.
Yeah.
Roosevelt was FDI, in our terms today.
Yeah. Right.
Roosevelt was an alcoholic.
Mm. Right. Is that just...
Dean Acheson was an alcoholic.
It's Mad Men. If anyone's ever watched Mad Men, the men just, you know, start drinking martinis at 9 o'clock in the morning and keep it going all day.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
That was the way.
And they still got things done. Wow. Sorry.
So in 1949, Philby becomes the liaison officer between MI6, or SIS, Secret Intelligence Services, they were sometimes called, and the CIA. He moves to Washington. How much do you think James Angleton had to do with the decision to get Philby in that job?
Probably not much. Mm. He would have, like an ambassador, he would have had to be approved by the Americans.
Right.
So, Adele Smith and Hoover and the others would have to say, that's okay, we'll deal with him.
Yeah.
It wasn't just CIA, it was the entire... intelligence constellation.
Mm.
30 years later somewhere.
So he's now got access not only to the secrets of MI6, but the entire American Secret Intelligence Service. And he's been a secret communist spy for this stage, nearly 14, 15 years.
He also had control over the secure communications.
Right. Well, that's handy.
Brilliant.
For that job.
Yeah. It's a good thing to have.
In our Korean War series, which we've been doing for the last, year, we just paused it at the point where, before China gets involved, MacArthur's just pushed the North back over the parallel. Can you talk about the role that Philby Burgess and MacLean played in the Korean War?
Before Burgess went to Washington, he was in the part of MI6 that dealt with the Far East. Mm-hmm. So the communications for the build-up to the Korean War went across his desk. Mm-hmm. And MacArthur thought that Burgess had spilled the beans.
Later, this is, after Burgess was revealed to be a Soviet spy.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Later.
Right.
You know, if you go to the archives in London, National Archive Q, you can get these files, folders, that have the basic communications. When the British Embassy are a part of the Foreign Office, we're putting out communications, you would have drafts, as you would. Mm-hmm. And these drafts would be circulated in the group, whatever was the relevant group. And the members of that group would then write comments on the left-hand column.
Wow.
And suggest changes. So you can go there and you can see Burgess writing suggestions about British policy in the Far East in these things that then get incorporated into the final communications.
Wow.
Fantastic. So from MacArthur's perspective, the stalemate in the Korean War had a lot to do with the Cambridge Five, members of the Cambridge Five, secretly passing on mostly American strategic thinking to Moscow, and from Moscow, I guess, to China, or to the North, I guess.
Yeah, I don't think that had any impact.
Really? No, I don't think so either.
MacArthur did it himself.
Right. Mm.
Yeah, he thought that the only way to defeat the Chinese was 5 atomic bombs. Mm-hmm. It meant that he had lost.
Yes. Right. Yeah, well, the Chinese were able to deploy was like something close to 2 million troops, which I don't think he'd really factored in the early days. And we've talked a lot about MacArthur's strategic thinking at various stages, at least in the first half of the war. You quote James MacArthur, who you call a particularly colourful American secret intelligence official, as saying that Philby and I were friends. Philby was a man of great charm. He had a pronounced stammer, which somehow didn't affect one's relations with him. When he started to stammer, you just waited, and he eventually found the word and went on. It sounds like working with Ray. You just wait, and eventually Ray will say something that makes sense. As I said to somebody later, we all came out of the Second World War floating on a sea of alcohol. Drinking was not a sin during the Second World War, and these habits stayed on. But Philby was the most extraordinary drinker I've ever come across. Many and many a night I saw him very, very drunk. His idea of heaven was a pitcher of martinis that you drank all night. And you have to wonder, like, for decades he's leading this double life, even when completely hammered drunk. And part of me wonders if the alcoholic version of him was a fake, that he wasn't really. Because how could you possibly, even if he was a sociopath, as you suggested, how could you get completely shit-faced drunk and never give away a hint that you're
of who you really are,
a communist spy or have communist leanings to anybody? Like, everybody was flabbergasted and shocked when it was suggested that he was a communist spy, let alone when he revealed himself decades later. Do you think the drinking might have been a fake? How is that possible?
I don't think the drinking was not a fake. The drinking was real. The division in the personality is not something that I'm qualified to talk about. It reminds me of people who survive torture,
mm-hmm.
you know, where they do that. They say, oh, well, this body that's in pain is not me.
Right.
And so people are capable of these things.
Well, I had an experience about that on the weekend, actually, a personal experience. I was tortured. I had a vasectomy. You haven't heard this story yet, Ray. Sorry. close your ears if you're sensitive to this, Michael. But I had a vasectomy on Saturday. And look, I've got my... still got my bag of peas.
I wasn't sure how he was going to show us.
No, it's not a bag of peas. Everyone relax. It's a bag of peas. I said vasectomy, not castration. And when the surgeon started to make the first incision after giving me a local, I went, oh, ha, 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 hey, oh, that really hurts. And he said, oh, well, might have to give you another local. Are you normally receptive to local anesthetic? And I said, well, the only time I've had it actually is when I have dental work done. And come to think of it, they normally have to hit me two or three times more than they do a normal person. So he goes, okay. So he hits me another couple of times and goes to work on the left side. And the pain is dulled to a roar from excruciating. Then he starts on the right side. I go, hey, oh, hey, hey, stop. What the hell, man? Did Ray pay you to hurt me like this? I mean, did Ray send you $1,000 to torture me?
Placebo.
And so he had to hit me another couple of times. And I was lying there on the table, disassociating myself from the pain, staring up at the ceiling, saying, it's just a thing. Every meditation trick in the book I had, and I've got a lot, I was pulling out going, it's just pain. It's don't think about it. Don't fight it. You don't, just... it'll be good. Think about all the my wives have been through giving birth, what Ray goes through every time he has to do a podcast with me. Just think about it. I had to disassociate. Yeah. I did ask him, do you have any whiskey? He said, you need another shot. I said, you got a bottle of whiskey? Because I've watched Deadwood. I know how you do it in the olden days. Just give me a stick to bite on and a bottle of, whiskey or moonshine to get me through this. It was and as I was leaving, the nurse said, she gave me this cup. The cup of cooler. It takes balls to get a vasectomy for people who aren't watching the video. And she said, ouch. Now, show this to your friends and pass on the word. I said, I'm going to talk about it on my podcast, lady. And she said, well, I hope you tell everyone it didn't hurt. And I go, hell no, I'm going to tell them. It hurt like a motherfucker. But it, but it's because I'm so superhuman that... local anesthetic apparently doesn't work on me very well. So anyway, maybe that's the trick that Philby pulled. Disassociation.
He was an actual alcoholic.
Well, that's amazing that he could do that and never give away a hint of his real self. It's stunning.
But he'd been faking it for, like you said, over 10 years, maybe it was second nature, even when drunk. I don't know. But it is quite astonishing.
Okay, so Angleton was also a noted alcoholic. In Legacy of Ashes, Tim Weiner wrote, Philby worked for Moscow out of a secure room in the Pentagon adjacent to the Joint Chiefs of Staff. His friendship with Angleton was sealed with the cold kiss of gin and the warm embrace of whiskey. He was an extraordinary drinker, knocking back a fifth a day, and Angleton was on his way to becoming one of the CIA's champion alcoholics, a title held against stiff competition. For more than a year before and after many a liquid lunch, Angleton gave Philby the precise coordinates for the drop zones for every agent the CIA parachuted into Albania. Though failure followed failure, death upon death...
That's not true.
Not
that's
true.
What?
That's not true.
Okay.
Oh.
What's the truth then?
The truth was that other CIA agents gave Philby that information. And also MI6 Angleton said, this isn't going to work.
Oh.
The Albania rollback. He said the Albanian, what do you call them, refugees, are completely infiltrated by the Soviets.
Yeah.
And there's no way this is going to work.
Yeah. And he was right.
He also said that about Bay of Pigs.
Right.
Bay of Pigs. Yeah.
Yeah.
He had, Angleton had his own agents.
Right.
Outside of the CIA or with
him. Wow.
And he kept saying, you know, this isn't going to work.
Yeah.
The Cubans know everything you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
That's amazing.
And so he wouldn't get involved, and Richard Helms would not get involved. He and Richard Helms were very close.
Right.
Right.
But that's what happened with Albania.
Well, just moving on with Tim Weiner, because I like the way he positions it here. Angleton was promoted to chief of counterintelligence when it was over. He held the job for 20 years. Drunk after lunch, his mind an impenetrable maze, his inbox a black hole, he passed judgment on every operation and every officer that the CIA aimed against the Soviets. He came to believe that a Soviet master plot controlled American perceptions of the world, and that he and he alone understood the depths of deception. He took the CIA's missions against Moscow down into a dark labyrinth. I don't really have a question about that. You may agree or disagree, but I just love the stories of these guys. It kind of reminds me of Dean Martin in the Matt Helm movies. Like, these guys sort of wanted to be the Rat Pack. But as we said before, it was probably a common thing for American men in those days just to, you know, do their job. They were what do you call it when they're alcoholics but can get the job done anyway? Functioning alcoholics.
High functioning, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, Weiner is playing one side of this war that went on in the CIA.
Mm-hmm.
Angleton's job was counterintelligence. His job was to prevent penetration of the CIA's operations by the enemy, whatever the enemy was at the time.
Right.
So an operator would say, we want to send a group of agents into Estonia to overthrow the communist government of Estonia.
Mm.
And here's their names, because they had to give Angleton the names, because he was supposed to vet them.
Right.
So Angleton would say, well, this one works for the Red Army, this one's a Nazi. I'm sure sometimes he said, oh, those are good guys. But the operators wanted him to okay everybody.
Right.
Because the way that you get promoted in an organization like that is you have operations, not your kind of operation.
Mm-hmm.
and so Angleton was blocking their careers.
Right.
And this is still going on. There are conferences where these people stand up and say, Angleton ruined my career, or ruined my father's career by not letting him invade Estonia.
Right.
So you need to kind of, as we said at the beginning, you know, stop dealing with these myths.
Right.
And look at evidence, try to figure out what was actually going on. This is quite beside the point of whether overthrowing the government of Estonia was a good thing.
Right.
Right.
Which is, it's now, most of those countries were fascist dictatorships in the 30s, and they're edging that way again.
Yeah. So there was, as there is today in American intelligence agencies, always internecine warfare going on, internal battles between agencies, inside the agencies for power, like there is in any organization. Little fiefdoms, people trying to push their agendas, get their friends promoted, et cetera, et cetera.
It sounds like at this point that Angleton takes his job very seriously. He's very good at it, and he's doing his due diligence by vetting these various people. Just other coworkers may not like it, but that's his job because he's trying to stop, you know, penetration. And I guess he makes enemies along the way. But again, he does seem to be very good at his job. He learned well from Philby.
Well, there weren't any infiltrations while Angleton was on the job. And when he was forced out, there was the Alger's Ames affair.
Right. That speaks volumes.
Except for the Philby penetration.
Well, that was before he was head of his counterintelligence.
Right. Philby was already in, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So in 1951, Philby gets involved in the hunt for Homer. The Venona cables, basically they figured out there's a Soviet spy inside the British service who turns out to be Donald McLean, at the time the head of the American Department Foreign Office. So he's a communist spy, gets involved in the hunt for a communist spy inside his own ranks. How does he handle that conflict?
Oh, he's very helpful. He says, you might also want to consider this. Here's the group of suspects.
Was his own name on the list? Was his own name on that list?
McLean's on the list.
No. Yeah. Did Philby put his own name on the list?
No, he didn't put his own name on the list. This happens over a relatively short period of time.
Right.
And Philby is one of the two people who are coordinating the hunt for Homer.
Mm-hmm.
And he acts in such a way that he's not suspected.
Mm.
But he has to deal, he has to protect McLean.
Wow.
And so that's when he tells Guy Burgess that he can't use the regular communication system. He can't send a wire to the head of the American Department saying, you better get out of Dodge.
Right.
So he says to Burgess, who's about to lose his job anyway, you go back to London and work out some way to go back to London, mm-hmm. and warn Donald. So Burgess does this intricate set of activities where he gets a lot of drunk driving violations mm-hmm. In Virginia and so forth, and he's declared persona non grata.
Right.
And he's sent back to London. And tells Donald McLean that we're leaving now.
Well, it's time to go.
So they.
And then when that's done, since Burgess had been Philby's lodger, people say,
yeah.
And why don't you go to London and explain this?
But it's. And this is where you think, oh, well, the story's over now. The cat's out of the bag. Burgess and McLean defect to the USSR. Burgess has been living with Philby. So this can't have looked good. And you would think that it's all over and that Philby too will defect and go, okay, the writing's on the wall, time's up, let's get out of here. But no, he doubles down and goes, what are you talking about? You're crazy. No, what? Yeah, me?
It's me, Philby.
Are you kidding me? No, I knew nothing. I had no idea. He doubles down and just faces it and just denies it and
sticks it out.
Gets away with it. It's an astounding, like the balls on this guy. It's astounding. Like not like
you keep coming back to that.
I do. I keep. I'm a little bit obsessed with balls at the moment. I'm sorry.
You could be forgiven.
Yeah, he's just like the.
Well, he says later when he's training KGB agents mm-hmm. that he never confessed.
Right. Yeah. Although he does eventually.
And in this case, there was no evidence.
Yeah.
Good point.
They had to have a confession.
Yeah.
Right.
Which also happened with Blake. And with Fuchs.
Right. Now, I've heard it suggested that if this hadn't have happened, if Burgess hadn't have been living with him and then defected at this time, Philby might have gone on to become the CSS, the Chief of the British Secret Service. Angleton...
Our deputy.
Right.
Our deputy.
Angleton certainly seems to have believed he would still get the job even after all this went down. He said to another guy, yeah, I still think he'll end up in the top job one of these days. What do you think?
You'd have to try to figure out what Angleton was trying to do by saying that.
Do you think Angleton suspected Philby by this point?
He suspected Philby when Burgess and McLean went to Moscow.
He did.
Gotcha. Okay. All right. Makes sense.
So Philby gets called back to England. Before he goes, Angleton asks to meet him for a drink at a bar, gives him an envelope, which he asks him to give the head of counterintelligence in London, saying he missed the courier bag and he wants it to get to him as soon as possible. And so there's this great situation where Philby's like, sure, I'll give the document to the head of counterintelligence in London. And he's wondering what's in the document. And, you know, does he not suspect me? Does he suspect me and thinks I'm going to open it and read it? And then they'll know if this information gets back to Moscow. And do we know what was in that document?
We don't know. We don't even know if that story is true.
Really? Oh, that's a shame because it's a great story. Who told the story? Philby. Yeah. It's straight out of a James Bond film, though, right? It's like you can just imagine this scene going down. It's totally beautiful. So Philby gets
a lot of Philby's book is directed at Angleton.
Right.
Mm. Wow.
Now Philby gets interrogated by, you know, pretty much everyone, MI6, MI5, and resigns from SIS, but he isn't beheaded. He just sticks around and, you know, keeps doing something. Why do you think he didn't go to Moscow as well at the time? He had work still to do?
He had work still to do.
Yeah.
The mission wasn't finished.
Right.
So he even gets defended by C at the time, the head of MI6. People are familiar with M.
Who knew his people.
Sorry?
Yeah.
Who knew his people.
Knew his people, right. Yes. This would have been Major General Sir Stuart Menzies. Is that right at the time, C?
Yeah.
I like what the novelist Ken Follett wrote about this. He said, Mr. Philby outwitted Menzies because Mr. Philby was intelligent and professional and cool, where Menzies was an amiable upper-class sportsman who was out of his depth. And British intelligence, except for the code breakers, was like Menzies, amateur, anti-intellectual, and wholly outclassed, which is actually how I would think more of the CIA than of British intelligence. I thought they had a lot more experience at it. What do you think of Follett's summary?
I don't think much go in for dramatic statements like that.
It's fun, though. Come on.
There's an SIS officer named Tim Milne.
Yeah.
Who was very close to Philby and who wrote a memoir that he didn't publish in his lifetime that was published a few years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's pretty accurate. And Milne is an intelligent man. In a big organization, you can't screen out all the intelligent people. And in the CIA, you have three divisions, right? You have intelligence, which is trying to get the secrets of other people or to prevent them from getting your secrets. Mm-hmm. You have operations, which is making a lot of noise, and you have analysis. And the analysis is pretty good. You get historians and so forth in analysis. And they get into the same kind of fights with the operators as the operators do with the counterintelligence people.
Mm-hmm. Right. So what were the repercussions for Menzies in having a spy in such a senior role in MI6 during his tenure?
I don't know. Did he retire? Probably retire.
Eventually, I think. Yeah.
But again, it just comes back to the class. Again, I'm just maybe because I'm an American and whatever, but this very small elite group was willing to back each other. Even though things looked bad, you're right, there was no evidence against Philby per se, but as long as he stayed cool, he stayed calm, his friends were backing him up, the worst thing that can happen is that he does have to step down, he does have to resign, whereas, like Cam, I was a little surprised. It's like, well, we can't even take a chance. There's a chance you might be a double agent, so we have to do something more stern with you, but that's simply not how they did things at the time.
There was a lot of pressure from the Americans.
Mm-hmm.
So what? Smith said, fire Philby or I'll break the relationship.
Ooh, wow. That's probably the only reason why Philby was removed, do you think?
Yeah, it's probably a good reason.
Gotcha. Yeah.
in his 1970s.
So Fiddley drifts around for a while.
Oh, right.
And has a lot of child support payments.
Mm-hmm.
Takes various odd jobs. And then his friends decide to help him.
Right.
And they get him this journalism job in Beirut.
Right. In his 1977 lecture to the members of the KGB, Philby said, "In the summer of 1951, McLean and Burgess arrived in the Soviet Union, leaving me in serious trouble. What to do? I enjoyed three great advantages. Many senior officers of SIS, from the chief downwards, would be greatly embarrassed if it were proved that I was working for the Soviet Union. They would certainly want to give me the benefit of any doubt. Second, I knew the SIS and MI5 archives in great detail. I knew the sort of evidence they could bring against me. Third, I knew British security procedures inside out. I knew that much of the information in the possession of the security authorities cannot be made the basis of a charge in the courts, as it either cannot be corroborated or comes from sources too delicate to be revealed. It was a long battle of nerve and wits lasting on and off for 5 years. Then I was informed by SIS that they had finally decided in my favour. They actually offered me a job as SIS agent in the Middle East, operating under journalistic cover."
Yep.
Wow. I mean, I know we're doing this with hindsight, but at the time, that's still staggering to me.
We knew his people.
He knew his people.
I need people. I have no people.
Hey, you got me. Hey, I got you.
I got you.
I got you.
Yeah, you're not as much of a man as you were a week ago, but that's fine.
Oh, okay. You're going to go there, right?
Sorry.
So
he goes to the Middle East.
Yes, sir.
He goes to the Middle East under journalistic cover, right?
Yeah. So J. Edgar Hoover's actual words were, "For my part, I conclude that Philby is as guilty as hell, but I don't see how you're ever going to prove it." So that was the situation. They just couldn't prove it.
Right.
Yeah.
And that's why they tried to get him to confess.
Right.
In Beirut.
Oh. Can I just be a brash American for a second? There's a chance that Philby might be a double agent or whatever. And we know that the CIA breaks all kinds of laws almost from the beginning of their existence. I guess there's never a question in MI6 of, well, forget the law for a second or forget manners for a moment. This guy might be a double agent. We have to remove him one way or the other. I guess I'm assuming that was just never a conversation that happened in London. Sometimes you just got to take matters into your own hands to straighten something out. But I guess they're all too busy being gentlemen. That never happened. And, Philby has to step down. I just wonder why no one's taken a more direct approach.
I don't think that's ever happened.
I'm sorry?
I don't think an employee of a British or an American secret intelligence agency was ever assassinated.
Ah, gotcha. Okay, so it just wasn't an option. Okay, thank you.
So when...
What do you take them for?
I'm sorry?
What do you take them for?
So when Dulles takes over the CIA, Angleton gets a promotion. Later on in life, towards the end of his life, Angleton gave Joseph Trento, author of a book called The Secret History of the CIA, an explanation of why he got a promotion and didn't get fired after all this went down, when his favorite drinking buddy turned out to be a Soviet spy, or at least was they thought he was. He says, "You know, I got to be in charge of counterintelligence. I agreed not to polygraph or require detailed checks on Alan Dulles and 60 of his closest friends. They were afraid that their own business dealings with Hitler's pals would come out. They were too arrogant to believe that the Russians would discover it all." We've talked a lot on our show about American support for Hitler before the war, from the likes of Prescott Bush and George Herbert Walker, who were the bankers for Fritz Thyssen, one of Hitler's major German financiers. And we know that the Dulles brothers were with Sullivan and Cromwell, an international law firm, before the war. What was their involvement with Hitler's pals that Angleton was referring to?
Banks.
Banking?
Banking.
Yeah, money. Right.
They were advising bankers that were working with German banks.
Right. So,
are they advising German banks?
Right.
And then there's this very curious thing about the relationship between Angleton and Dulles. Dulles built his career in the CIA on what he called Operation Sunrise,
mm-hmm.
the surrender of German troops in Italy. And it appears to me and it appeared at the time to Angleton that this was an SS initiative.
Mm.
That it wasn't Dulles being clever.
Right.
It was the SS being clever.
Yeah.
That General Wolf, who was the SS general in charge in Italy, was trying to not go to Moscow. It was very bad to go to Moscow.
Yes. Right.
And there was a general effort by the German army to surrender to the British and Americans.
Oh, right.
And not to go to Moscow. And it appears that at least Dulles was being used by Wolfe to do this.
Mm.
Now, Angleton thought that that was what was happening at the time. And he tried to stop it.
Wow.
And then 9 years later, he's Dulles' best friend. So, well, 9 years is a long time.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, we covered that story, I think, on a couple of episodes. And Dulles obviously took credit for it, and it was a big boost to his career as an intelligence guy.
Right. Oh, my God.
All right, well, moving on. In 1955, Philby gets called the third man in the House of Commons, 6 years after the film of the same name, great film, with Orson Welles in his Cuckoo Clock speech. But Harold Macmillan, who was the Foreign Secretary at the time, again says there's no evidence against Philby. Philby still doesn't run to Moscow. And I think on the biography show that we did about Philby many years ago, I found a clip on YouTube of Philby being interviewed on the BBC at the time about these allegations. And he's all just very British and it was obviously complete nonsense.
Very smooth.
Very smooth. Like no tells.
Yes.
Like just completely
his hands didn't
flawless.
Shake. Yeah.
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 I would have been on the fastest jet out of there to Moscow, but I'm a coward. Still, he doesn't waver. He just holds tight. And as we said before, they end up giving him a job. He goes to Beirut during the Suez Canal affair as a secret MI6 agent, this time not as an officer, he's an agent.
After Suez Canal.
Mm-hmm. After the Suez Canal, right. He's undercover as being a journalist for both The Observer and The Economist, obviously still secretly reporting to the Soviets. He visits his father. Do you think at this point his father knows anything about his secret life, or does he hide it from St. John as well?
It's St. John.
Okay.
I don't know, and I don't think it's very important, and I don't think it would have been very important to his father.
Mm.
Oh, you're working for the Soviets against the British Empire. That's nice stuff.
Yeah. Welcome to the club.
Yeah. I just have to ask real quick, and I think I'm going to anticipate your answer, but again, for Philby, even though there seems to be some pressure, Is it arrogance? Is it courage? Or is it, again, the job is not done? I'm still a vital thing to the communist cause, and so I will stick it out and keep providing information. I mean, is it that just that's the way it is for him? He's just still got a job to do.
Yeah.
Wow. I still call that courage. I'm sorry, Cam. Go ahead.
Well, while in Beirut, he's been closely watched by everybody, including the CIA, including he's being watched by a CIA agent called Miles Copeland, Miles Axe Copeland Jr., the father of Stuart Copeland, the drummer from The Police,
wow.
And the father of Miles Axe Copeland III, the manager of The Police and Sting. And these boys are in Beirut growing up while this is happening. Like, this is a crazy story. Angleton apparently told Copeland, I know Philby is a Soviet agent. But Copeland doesn't believe it. Many years later, in 1963, Copeland says, if Philby was a communist, he was the best actor in the world. And this was quite unbelievable. He would have had to construct a fantastic intellectual framework and stick to it moment by moment, all tending to a liberal viewpoint. But apparently that's what he did. Like, he was...
That's exactly what he
astounding.
Did.
Astounding. Absolutely astounding. So...
So, Copeland... Go on. So the interesting thing that I found about Philby and Beirut is what a good journalist he was.
Yes. I enjoyed that part of your book.
I tried to quote all of the articles, but my editor said I can't.
No, that was amazing.
They're really great. And the reporting from Yemen is particularly pertinent these days. Exactly the same thing was going on in 1959 as is going on now.
Right.
He said it was the country where there were more machine guns than typewriters.
Wow.
And that tells you.
So that was going on. So he was a very good journalist.
Mm-hmm.
And then gradually he started missing deadlines.
Mm-hmm.
And this was either because the alcohol was finally getting to him or that he realized what was going on, that everyone who was at the cocktail parties were an agent for someone or another.
Watching him.
We're trying again.
Wow, that's a lot of pressure. That's a lot of pressure.
But he doesn't stop having a good time. Eileen Philby, his second wife, dies. He ends up having what I think you describe as a very alcoholic affair with, and then marrying in 1959 an American, Eleanor Brewer, the wife of a prominent New York Times journalist, Sam Pope Brewer. She moves to Beirut to be with him, takes her teenage daughter with Sam Brewer. And then I recall he also later on, when he's in Moscow, has an affair with Donald McLean's wife. So...
Who's a very interesting person.
He would have to be.
He's a real ladies' man.
Yeah, she would have to
be. She was?
She's a very interesting.
Which one? Brewer?
Very interesting. No.
Oh, McLean's wife? Right. And
I think she was a spy.
I dug up, when they go to Moscow, I dug up an article in the New York Times saying Sam Brewer's wife and daughter have gone missing. Their whereabouts are unknown. If anyone knows about them, please get in contact.
Wow.
That's like horrifying for him. His teenage daughter just disappears off the map, right?
Yeah, he eventually gets
custody.
Of the team.
So then in December 1961, just to try and wrap up the story, because I know it's dragging on, but it's your book. In December 1961, Golitsyn, KGB officer, defects to the CIA, reveals the existence of the Cambridge Five, identifies a third man with the code name Stanley, and this is really the beginning of the end for Philby, isn't it?
He loses a lot of friends over that, yeah. Golitsyn, these defectors are interesting. They often come defect, not those that go to Moscow, those that go to Washington.
Mm-hmm.
They have some legitimate information that they then use to bargain with. And Golitsyn had some. And then they use that up. And they have nothing more to say or to sell. And so they start making things up.
Right.
So there was a member of the Polish Secret Intelligence Service who had a Polish name that I can't pronounce, who defected to... he thought he was defecting to the FBI because he said the CIA was riddled with Soviet agents. But actually, the people he thought were FBI agents were CIA agents. and he had a lot of information, the names of agents and things like that. And when he ran out of that information, he said, by the way, I forgot to tell you that I'm the son of the late Tsar of Russia.
Of course.
Wow.
Isn't everybody? Yeah. Well, Golitsyn did well out of his defection. I think he was made an honorary commander of the Order of the British Empire. He was made an American citizen. He lived to a ripe old age, died in 2008, aged 82. So it worked out well for him, but not so well for Philby. Well, I guess he was okay too. So he gets interviewed again by SIS, and then they either force a confession out of him or he volunteers a confession at this stage. Why is he confessing now when he's been denying it all these years? Is it just too much out there now?
We're talking about
Philby. Yeah, sorry.
We're talking about Philby. Oh, he didn't confess. MI6 sent out his guy who thought he was a good friend of Philby's. This was a widespread illusion.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a confession written out.
Oh.
The MI6 person had a confession.
All right.
And he said, we've got you. We know you're a spy. I want you to sign this confession. Right. And this was obviously at a cocktail party, of course. And so Philby says, you're right. You've got me. I'll sign it in the morning.
Right.
And in the morning, they can't find him.
Why didn't they arrest him?
Well, they can't arrest him. They don't have arresting power on the in Beirut.
Wow.
Ah.
If you think you're going to get arrested, you should go to another country.
Right.
Right.
It's a procedure.
That doesn't have
a
treaty.
So that's very convenient. So... He disappears, and
extradition.
And he seems to suggest, if I recall correctly, in his own book, that they wanted him to disappear. That this was kind of a nod, wink, wink, nod, nod. Would be really best for everybody if you just disappeared for a long period of time.
Yeah,
wouldn't you?
Well, it's going to be very embarrassing to everybody if it's revealed that a guy of this stature was a spy to the Americans and to the British. And if he just disappears and no one really knows what happened to him, and it's just, well, we don't know, maybe he fell in a hole somewhere and we just haven't found him, then, you know, the story moves on and you can talk about something else for a while.
Yeah, that may be the case. I think Angleton wanted to get him.
Right.
It was personal?
The Brits may not have wanted to
get him. Right.
Yeah.
I would have thought it's just as embarrassing for the Americans as for the Brits. What kind of a great spy can you be as Angleton if you've been drinking with a communist spy for 20 years who is your mentor and you never picked up on anything? I mean, that's pretty embarrassing. How do you keep your job?
Well, that's what you drink.
Okay.
It wouldn't have been as big a deal.
Really? That's... Right. Yeah. Shocking to me.
Different times.
All right, well, let's wrap up the story. What happens to Philby and Angleton after this?
Well, Angleton, the Gallitzin thing was just a problem inside the CIA.
Mm-hmm.
Angleton was a very good friend of Richard Helms, who later becomes director of the CIA, and thus Angleton's untouchable. He also carpooled. Before that, he carpools with Dulles. He gave Dulles rides to work. So no one was going to do anything with Angleton.
Wow.
When he gets this kind of quasi-public role in Washington. When the Warren Commission is formulated, Angleton is made the CIA's delegate to the Warren Commission to assure them that the CIA had nothing to do with the assassination. And then he does similar things like that. He's also put in charge of special operations, which always means things you don't want to talk about. So there was the project where all international mail from the United States was opened by the CIA and opened and read. What a dull job. But anyway,
right.
They did that. Also, the telegrams, the ITT made this easier by taking the magnetic tapes that had the international telegrams on them and giving them to the CIA.
Wow.
So they didn't have to have a special operation at the airport. There were a lot of projects like that occurred. When they wanted to do something about the student uprisings in the 60s, Angleton wrote the report on that on Operation Chaos. Then William Colby becomes head of the CIA.
Mm-hmm.
Angleton thought that Colby was a Soviet agent.
Gee, I wonder why.
Well, he thought he was an agent before.
Right.
I interviewed a CIA official who had been part of Angleton's shop, who was in Vietnam during the war. And they said that Colby had this ambiguous position. Have you done a show on Colby?
No, not yet. He's a little bit further down the timeline for where we're at.
Yeah, you know, Colby was in charge of that genocide program in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And the CIA guy said they wouldn't let him into the office because they knew that he was working for the other side.
Wow.
Oh, my goodness.
So that was the belief, anyway, right, in Angleton's staff.
Mm.
Colby becomes director. He says that Angleton's too weird and fires him. And then he dissolves the counterintelligence unit of the CIA.
Mm.
Now, you recall that the counterintelligence unit's job was to prevent infiltration.
Mm-hmm.
So Colby dissolves this. So the CIA has no defense against infiltration.
That seems bad.
You know, Colby died under mysterious circumstances.
No, really?
Yeah.
Oh, it's getting dark quick.
Colby fired Angleton. Angleton was rehired the next day as a consultant at the same salary by the CIA, and spends a lot of time testifying to Congress and advising people on things like that.
Mm.
Comes down with lung cancer, and then his wife came back and went away. Came back.
Wow.
Colby, once he was in Moscow, the KGB tried to dry him out, which didn't work. They were not quite sure that he wasn't not a double agent, but a triple agent.
Wow.
They thought that maybe he was spying on the KGB for the MI6. So they spent a long time kind of watching him and trying to find. Eventually, they made him an instructor in the spy school. And there's a lecture. Did you get that lecture to the Stasi, where he talks to them about how to be a good secret intelligence agent?
Read bits of it, yeah.
And Graham Greene goes to Moscow to visit him, and they get drunk together. He kind of just peters out.
Right.
The KGB finds him a nice wife, fourth one. Who takes care of him as these things happen.
Right.
Angleton then gets sick with lung cancer and dries out for the first time in his life as non-alcoholic. And then, if you want to wind this up, there's this dramatic deathbed speech that's in the Trento book.
I have the quote in front of me.
I've
got the quote in front of me. As Angleton was dying, he told Trento, "You know, the CIA got tens of thousands of brave people killed. We played with lives as if we owned them. We gave false hope. I so misjudged what happened. Fundamentally, the founding fathers of US intelligence were liars. The only thing they had in common was a desire for absolute power. I did things that I regret. But I was part of it and loved being part of it. Alan Dulles, Richard Helms, Carmel Offey, and Frank Wisner were the grand masters. If you were in a room with them, you were in a room full of people that you had to believe would deservedly end up in hell." Angleton slowly sipped his tea and then said, "I guess I will see them there soon."
Wow.
It's a great ending.
It's a great ending and a great, like, last words. Wow.
Yeah. And just to let the listeners know, we have left a lot out. You should definitely check out this book because the details are absolutely astounding.
It's a
story that unfolds.
Tremendous read, we've taken up 2.5 hours of your time just hitting the high points. We recommend it to everybody. Thank you for spending so much of your night talking to us, Michael.
Thank you. It's been very entertaining.
has descended across the continent.